Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Book Network. I'm Ronay Bakan, one of the hosts for a special series on Kurdish studies. And today I'm delighted to host Dr. David Loipod to talk about his remarkable book, Embattled Dreamland, The Politics of Contesting Armenian, Kurdish, and Turkish Memory. Dr. David Loipod is a sociologist and a research fellow at the Leibniz Zentrum Moderne Orient Berlin. He was a 2018 and 19 Monoghan postdoctoral fellow in the University of Michigan, Department of Sociology, and holds a doctoral degree from the Humboldt Universität zu Berlin. His research interests comprise contested geographies and the collective imaginations of past, present, and future in the post-Ottoman and post-Soviet space. The book subject to this talk, Embattled Dreamlands, The Politics of Armenian, Kurdish, and Turkish Memory, was also awarded the 2021 Annual Book Prize of Central Eurasian Studies Society. He is fluent, aside from his native language German, in English, Turkish, Persian, Armenian, and Russian. Dr. David Loipod, welcome. Thank you for joining us today. And I wonder if you'd like to begin the interview by saying a few words about yourself first.
Sure, thank you, with pleasure. I was born right at the end of the Cold War into, I think, what we could describe a non-academic, typical lower middle class family. And I grew up in a small town right along the German-Czech border. It's only miles away from the former Iron Curtain. Before my compulsory military service, I had the chance to participate in a German-Turkish youth exchange program, which brought me to the western Turkish industrial town of Torbalı, close to Izmir. I was, from the very first moment, really mesmerized by both people, music, everything from grunge to arabesque and sanat music. And then, just a year later, I found myself enrolled in Ottoman and Iranian studies, back then at the University of Bamberg. There, during an exchange year at the Ege University, Izmir, I had the chance to meet a Kurdish student with whom I became a very close friend, who turned out to be from a partially Islamized Syriac background. So in spring break, we had the chance then to travel together to both his hometown, Batman, as well as the cities of Mardin and Diyarbakir, so regions with substantial non-Muslim populations before the Armenian and the Syrian genocide a century ago. I would say that, retrospectively thinking back, that this formed somehow the point of departure for my personal and then ultimately also academic interest in the repressed histories and also contested geographies of the geography we refer to as Anatolia. So, I think over the following years, two scholars had a profound impact here on me. One was the German sociologist Klaus Eder and his interest in collective mobilization, violence, and memory. And the other was the US Armenian or historian Ronald Suni, whose decade-long research on the fall of empires and the rise of nations extends likewise from the Soviet geography to the what we could refer to as the post-Ottoman space.
Thank you so much. Such a fascinating story. Let's talk a little bit about the book as well. So Embattled Dreamlands is a fascinating book which sheds light on the conflictual nature of memory building in the age of nation state, broadly speaking. Could you elaborate a little bit about this conflictual relationship between nation building and memory building and the idea of Embattled Dreamlands that you are unpacking throughout your book?
Yeah, sure. I think this is a very important question. And memory building on a state level, or Geschichtspolitik, that is the politics of history, as we call it in German, I think it plays a crucial role in the whole process of nation state building. It is the realm where the nation and the nation state is first imagined, and then, as we know, projected as a historical fact back into primordial history. So while national historiography claims to merely discover the nation as a historical fact, what it actually does here is, of course, a creative invention of the nation in a very modern sense, right? So here, memory regimes as resort to different tools of manipulation and silencing to achieve this goal. Facts that do not correspond to one's own national narrative are here sidelined, marginalized, and repressed. This holds true, I think, virtually for all national narratives. For example, now turning more to the case, the Turkish narrative forgets not only the genocide as what Taner Akçam called the foundational crime of the Turkish Republic, but also how an amalgam of Muslim refugees from the Balkans and the Caucasus, Pomaks, Albanians, Bosniaks, Chechens, Udige, Abkhazians, were assimilated and blended into what then only retrospectively be known as a unified Türk ulusu, or Turkish nation. But of course, the same also holds true, I think, in an equal sense for the Armenian narrative. For I think it is only the massive influx of genocide survivors in 1915, 1916 that really shifted the demographic balance in Caucasian Armenia, that is corresponding to the present-day geography of Armenia, in favor of a clear Armenian majority in demographic terms. So what has the Armenian narrative here to say about the mosques of Yerevan and its surroundings, or the Muslim populations, both Kurds and Turkic speakers, that outnumbered Armenians in counties like Surmalo or Sharul Daralyaz, for instance? And when we turn to the Kurdish narrative, of course, here we have an open recognition of the Armenian genocide. But at the same time, can we really say that we fully already came to terms with the question of ishtirak, that is, complicity of Kurds in the genocide? Well, whether that was backed by religious leaders or for personal economic gains, as for instance, scholars like Fırat Aydınkaya note in the book Suç ve Utanç, without Kurdish participation, it would have been impossible to cleanse Armenians from what we can refer to as Turkish Kurdistan. So accordingly, the past, if understood more in the sense of Walter Benjamin as a critical resource of knowledge, is, I think, still constantly haunting nation states, and the acts of suppressing memory, accordingly, demands huge resources from them.
Thank you so much. In my opinion, one of the biggest strengths of this book is the great range of empirical material that you draw on to trace the politics of contesting Armenian, Kurdish, and Turkish memory building projects. And I wonder whether you can tell us about the research process on this highly contested area of study, and what methods did you employ, and what kind of challenges and unexpected discoveries did you encounter during this process, if at all?
Yeah, thanks. Very much appreciated, because I fully agree that the extensive fieldwork that I conducted in both Armenia and Eastern Turkey, that is the extended Lake Van region, I think it really formed the backbone of this study. Having lived and studied previously in Turkey, I, as I mentioned already, did an exchange here at the Ege University, which was then followed up by an MA degree in social science at the Middle Eastern Technical University in Ankara. So I had already the chance, living together with students from Turkey, to acquire language proficiency in Turkish and also to a less extent in Kurmanji Kurdish. There was a Kurdish cultural center in Maltepe, Ankara. Not sure whether it still does exist, where I took classes back then. So in Turkey, I think my fieldwork was in some sense easier from the very outset. However, politically, it became more difficult because it coincided with the general elections of the year 2015. And thus, the atmosphere was both somehow hopeful, but at the same time, also very politically tense. And I did not know it back then, but in retrospect, I had operated in a very narrow time window because it was just months before the attack in Suruç and the subsequent full re-escalation of the conflict, also in military terms, right? So just a few months later, I think my fieldwork would have been not only not possible, but I think entirely impossible to implement in this form. So fieldwork in Armenia, on the other hand, I think it was more challenging from the very outset. I had no illusions about that. I had to learn Armenian within a very short time frame. And as my focus was the memory of the Lakhvan region, a very important preliminary element of my studies was to first locate Armenians descending from that area all across present-day Armenia. So here, local ethnographers proved incredibly helpful to me. And regarding methods, I think I found biographical narrative interviewing, as it is also developed and proposed by the sociologist Fritz Schütze, to be particularly useful. Because here it focuses on really revealing the informant's, what we call again in German, interne Bedeutungsstrukturen, that is the internal structures of meaning that we all employ to make sense of the imagined and experienced past that we refer to. Regarding what kind of impressed me, of course, there were many things, and it feels a bit now difficult to go back to those years. But I think what really impressed me was what I maybe could call a porosity and the inner contradictions of those memory narratives. For instance, I remember one instance, we were sitting at Rakı and Meze at the evening in Van, in the city of Van, and a Kurdish teacher first told me about the harmonious coexistence of both Armenians and Kurds in his village at the southern shores of Lake Van, all before the genocide. But then when we slowly approach the question of 1915, this more harmonious story suddenly breaks off, and he ends up telling me how, just minutes later, how the villagers threw Armenians off the cliffs to their deaths. So I think this actual traumatic and hard to digest truth here was not, and I think that's important, it was not that the first proposition, the harmonious coexistence, was false and the second one was the true story. I think the real kind of traumatic kernel of this is that, as also scholars like Jan Gross, for example, showed in his book Neighbors on the Jewish Holocaust, the very hard to digest truth is that both propositions, so both the peaceful coexistence and the murderous violence that ensued, were both equally historically real. And I think we can see this, of course, unfortunately, repeating in global history, in, for example, the dynamics of other conflicts. We can just think of the Bosnian War in the 1990s that really suddenly tore asunder the societal fabric that had held together this very multi-ethnic society in what had been Yugoslavia. So yeah, I think that was for me one of like the maybe most kind of impressive things that I did learn throughout that fieldwork.
Thank you so much. Such a brilliant way to put it, the possibility of both peace and violence in our histories. So if we go into more detailed discussion in chapter one, Saving the Empire, Killing Its Subject, you first lay out the history and causal relationship between the killing and mass expulsion of Muslims from Circassia in 1864 and 1867 by the Tsarist army and Armenian genocide in 1915 to 1918 by the Ottoman Empire. Can you expand on this history a little bit more for our audience and what you may consider as possible implications of these histories in contemporary politics in the region, especially regarding like memory building and politics of memory?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Rone. Exactly. I think I'm very happy that you specifically bring up this aspect of the study, because I think it's a very crucial one. I think unlike other previous studies, I can claim that I do not understand the Armenian Genocide here as a merely singular historical event. To already put it like this is, I think, not making me many friends on the Armenian national side. But as you already saw in the previous responses, the work also didn't very much set out to embrace any of the national strengths, neither the Kurdish nor the Turkish, for obvious reasons. But what I see, and this is the thing that was revealed to me, I think, also during the historical study that constituted an important part of my research, I think that what we see in unfolding in the momentum of the Armenian Genocide stands in a very longer continuity of mass violence that is at the intersection point from empire to nation state, and that encompasses different empires, both the Ottoman Empire, but also, as I will talk now, the Tsarist Empire. What is important here, and I think that's something that scholars like my mentor Ron Suni is stressing often, empires did not simply leave the stage of history and left their space to the emerging nation states, because the problem is empires didn't know that they were determined, condemned to erasure by history. Instead, at that time, they tried to fashion themselves as kind of new paradox forms, that is, ethno-national empires. This happened, of course, also with regard to other empires, when we think of Habsburg. Of course, this brought empires at odds with their own multi-ethnic demographical structure. So the national empire was, from the very outset, I would say, an impossible dream. Populations different in religion or language were then seen by the waning empires as suspicious at best and outright treacherous at worst. The Tsarist Empire and its cleansing of its Muslim Adige and Ubig populations, known under the umbrella term of Circassians or Cherkesler, from the Northern Caucasus, and the Ottoman Empire and the destruction of its own Christian, Assyrian, and Armenian communities, I want to show here, and this is what I stressed, it follows the same fatal logic. And this logic, by the way, I think it is not unique to imperial policies of the 19th, 20th century, but I think it perfectly also corresponds to what we see on an individual level when we turn to the arguments of Alfred Adler, one of the leading representatives of depth psychology, Tiefenpsychologie. By analogy, we can say states facing their own demise are equally plagued by a kind of nagging inferior complex that may at any point escalate into violent outbursts. And I think the wounds of this violence persist to this day. So responding to the question what implication this has also to present-day politics, well, I think one example that has become very important, I think, over the last year was how memory played a crucial role in the wake of the war between Armenia and Azerbaijan on the region of Nagorno-Karabakh, or Artsakh, how it is referred to in Armenian. Back then, the Armenian Prime Minister, for instance, Nikol Pashinyan, would emphatically evoke the genocide in order also to mobilize Armenian support in the war. He would refer to as Saim Nor Sadarapate, this is our new Sadarapat, referring to the Armenian battle during the Caucasus warfare in World War I. And he continues here, I quote, "They did not come just to conquer territories, villages, or cities. Their goal is the Armenians. Their goal is to continue their policy of the Armenian genocide," end quote. So what we see here, we have new wars, we have new territorial contestations, but we see at the same time how they are framed within the historical continuity of what happened exactly now a century or over a century ago. That is, everything that happened was genuinely, and I think that's the most interesting thing. I don't think that this was just only, let's say, political opportunism or pragmatic or any, a pragmatic way of mobilizing populations. I think that he honestly believed that the second genocide was looming in the last Karabakh war. So I think that is a good way, I think, how we can see how the shadow that was cast by the violence that happened over a century ago is still informing the political reality we're living in today.
Thank you so much. It really seems like a strong historical approach like yours will be leveraging our understanding of conflict today in the region. Following up on that, in chapter 2, Eternal Histories and Elusive Homelands, you emphasize the interdependency between these conflicting narratives, between competing nationalism and memory building projects. And I was wondering whether you can elaborate more on this, like conflicting narratives and their interdependency, especially in the context of One Lake region.
Yeah, of course. Like from the very outset, I was very curious to explore memory, not along this simplistic divide of victim and perpetrator that would be the kind of battles, the memory wars, as we call it, that unfold on the level of official memory politics in Armenia and Turkey. That was also something that I looked at within the framework of memory politics. I looked, for example, how in some way the commemorations of the Armenian genocide at the centennial of the of Aret in 2015 were somehow speaking to each other in a way to what was the Turkish blocking myth to it, that is the commemoration of the Çanakkale Zaferi, the victory at Gallipoli, which coincided this in the same year, and it formed something like a blocking myth that is a counter narrative that blocks out what would be the other historical narrative, that is that historical narrative of mourning, of commemoration of an event of mass killing, right? But for me, it was always very interesting to look at it within this the triangle that evades this clear-cut, any clear-cut binaries of victim-perpetrator, that is ultimately understanding the thematic complex of 1915 in this triangle of the Armenian, Turkish, and Kurdish. I think it's something that is very much specifically at the forefront of more recent studies, I think, on 1915, both in historical terms, but also I think of different anthropological works that explore this also within the same framework. For that reason, I ultimately opted for focusing on Van. Initially, I also had been thinking about looking at Ani, at Kars, at this area, because it was also a region that was of very important historical significance for Armenians and also is located within present-day Turkey. But what I felt a bit missing was that actually places like Kars, Ardahan, they are actually less contested, I think, when we think of present-day Turkish politics. That is, they are maybe at best something like a geographical periphery of an imagined Bakure Kurdistan, an imagined northern Kurdistan. Thus, I was looking for a region that is of significant relevance and had been for all three communities, that is, Armenians, Turks, and Kurds, over the last centuries at best. So, and that is a region, I think, the Lake Van region comprising the old provinces, the Ottoman provinces of both Bitlis and Van today. It is located, I think, at the nexus where an imagined Turkish, Armenian, and Kurdish homeland really geographically collide. For Armenians, there are, I think, two localities here which are of significant relevance. That is both Kars, which I mentioned, and the other, which had been really also perceived as a kind of imagined capital of a to-be freed Western Armenia already in the late Ottoman period, that is Van. And Van, of course, without going too much back into history, played a significant role in the Armenian kingdom of Vaspurgan. But I think what's important is that today also, for when we think of the Kurdish movement, both in political and also cultural terms, I think alongside what is regarded as the unofficial capital of an imagined northern Kurdistan, that is for sure Ahmet Diyarbakir, I think Van is also of significant cultural relevance in the imaginary of the Turkish, the region inhabited by Kurds in present-day Turkey. It is, I think, exactly the geographical site where Armenians, Kurds, and Turkish imaginations of a national homeland collide into one place. And, or as my mentor Ronald Sunik summed it up, I think, brilliantly in the foreword of the book, imagine geographies collide in the Van region. Western Armenia bleeds into northern Kurdistan, and both are assumed by Turks to be Turkey. So I think that is basically, in a nutshell, why Van and what's the significance in this work.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you so much. It was brilliant to read about this interdependency of competing nationalism while all of them kind of like claim to a sort of uniqueness. And I think it was really interesting to see in that way and see them like talking to one another and building each other. So next question on chapter 3, Mirrored Narratives. You map out different strategies, namely narrating, silencing, performing, and renaming, mapping, in discerning how state and state-like organizations employ a great range of resources to produce or reproduce their own interpretations of like national narrative. So I was wondering whether you could talk a little bit more about how these strategies of remembering and forgetting have been historically mobilized in the One Lake region with reference to Armenian, Kurdish, and Turkish case.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I'm a bit afraid that I will a bit fall short of being able to fully answer this question, but I think I will be at least able to give you a bit of a glimpse specifically with regard to two aspects, that is specifically that of performing and mapping and its relevance with regard to the Lake Van region, because I've partially already addressed the question of silencing, but as in the book, this is something that I discuss more on the larger level, that is on this on the official level. I was analyzing their school books, and here I was more capturing the overall narratives that encompass the whole of Turkey and Armenia. However, with regard to performing and also renaming of space, I specifically engage with the question of what does the landscape, the actual geography of the Lake Van region play, which role does it play, which space does it occupy in the narratives, in the national narratives of both Armenians, Kurds, and Turks. And I think the monumental landscapes plays a crucial role here in fostering national memory or collective memory in general. It's a process which has been described by scholars like Münkle, for example, as a Verdenkmalung of space, that is a monumentalization of space, that is mythical places which are not necessarily endowed a priori with any national meaning, they become to be to form centerpieces in a kind of in the mnemonic landscape of the nation. That can be, for example, cemeteries or places of worship that come to be understood ex post as historical landmarks of the nation. At the same time, those buildings which are perceived as not fitting, and I think that's the interesting part here, which are perceived as jeopardizing, as threatening to one's own narrative, often end up to be erased. We see this with regard to different, I think, cases. We see this in the erasure, for example, of the historical remains of rural Jewry in Germany during the Holocaust. We see this, of course, also with regard to the newly forming homogenizing ethno-national states on the Balkans. So I think there are different examples globally to which we can link this observation. So examples from the specific region of Lake Van, I think they're manifold. Maybe I suffice myself here with addressing briefly the question of cemeteries. And there I think it's interesting to see that the cemeteries left by the Seljuk Turks in the town of Ahlat, north of Lake Van, how they are kind of framed by the Turkish Ministry of Culture. Specifically, when you compare this, of course, to the like deafening silence when it comes to Armenian or Yezidi cemeteries in the same region, which have been rather deliberately demolished or left to decay. So what's interesting is that when we look at how the Seljuk Turkish cemeteries are framed, they are framed in this provincial town of Ahlat as a dome of Islam, like Kubbetül Islam, or resort of the Turks, Tüklün Urak Yeri. And at the same time, and that's the interesting part, right? On the one hand, we have these cemeteries that end up playing a crucial role in the international narrative. They become part of this monumental landscape. While at the same time, if they were most probably located in just a couple of kilometers across the border in Armenia or in Georgia, most probably they would have ended up with a fate that befell most Armenian cemeteries or Assyrian cemeteries in the Lake Van region. That is, they end up being perceived as irritating obstacles on the way towards inscribing a coherent national narrative into the landscape, and most probably would end up being removed. So, however, and I think that is maybe the most interesting part, we are really mistaken if we assume that demolition of a material legacy might analogically cause also its erasure in mnemonic terms, that is, things end up being forgotten. For often the names of places reminiscent of the so-called disappeared other, that is, populations that have been removed, populations that have been killed, communities that have been erased. The interesting thing is that the traces they actually leave behind. And I think one of the, let's say, maybe less evident trace that is not a material trace is to see how that even after a name-giving locality ceases to exist, that is, we have a destruction of a monastery, of a church, places might still be remembered in association with these specific historical localities. To give there another example that is more from the western side of the Lake Van region, west of Mush, we have there the former Armenian monasteries of Shishhorovank and Mamgavank. And what's interesting is that when I was visiting those places together with some local colleagues, which were roughly my own age, so obviously born many generations after 1915 and after the destruction of these historical buildings, they would still refer to this place as Tepe Eder. That is literally, if you translate it from Kurdish, as the Church Hill. And even by the younger generation of the surrounding villages. And the same is also true for the former sites of Armenian cemeteries, which are often generally referred to as Zivia Fella, that is the field of the non-Muslim, or the Tepe Fella, the hill of the non-Muslim. So while disappeared populations can be written out of history textbooks quite with ease, as demonstrated, I think, in this discussion on mapping and imagine inscribing the narrative into space, the erasure of these traces from the actual mnemonic landscape proves to be a far more troublesome task than the mere physical erasure of these buildings.
Thank you so much. Your book indeed pushes us to think about nation and memory building in concrete ways, rather than thinking such processes as just the result of certain abstract ideas. It's really fascinating. Lastly, in chapter 5, Entwined Narratives, you go beyond the notion of collective memory building, collective memory as simply being national memory. And I found this really an interesting way to think about memory building projects. And you instead propose multi-collective memory as a novel approach in memory studies, as well as an alternative approach to understand and battle dreamlands in the region. And I was wondering whether you can explain further what you mean by multi-collective memory and how it is you think that unraveled in the region.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I think this is really the question that lies at the heart of the book. And I also somehow have to critically, of course, also assess the way how I on my own am compelled to frame my research when I'm trying to introduce it, right? I mean, I myself always resort to speaking of Armenian, Kurdish, Turkish narratives, right? But because that is the kind of, by convention, the way in which we normally tend to discuss these topics, if it is not even at the more binary of the victim and perpetrator divide. So, but in reality, of course, and that is now a kind of truism, but I will try to flesh that out more with also more contextual insight. Things are, of course, more complicated. Regarding social memory, I think an implicit understanding prevails that nations somehow form monolithic communities of collective memory, which is somehow interesting given the fact that the nation state and the ethnos as in effect has been rather deconstructed and as a general consensus. But I think that the idea of certain communities of collective memory, which I think really form this very idea that we have coherent communities of remembrance, I think that this is really the kernel that really underpins the national myth. But it is, I think, very often reproduced in political speeches, journalistic articles, public debates, but also academic works. And I think that happens every time that we kind of either consciously or unconsciously evoke the idea, so let's see how this or that nation remembers, right? This is how, I mean, this is the things we constantly, I think, read when we just take a newspaper, right? Even if the intention of a given article might be good, right? This is how the Armenians cannot forget, the Turks remember. But what do we actually mean when we evoke, when we conjure up these collective categories? So as I promised, I don't want to just confine myself with this kind of common postmodern truism of the boundaries are more fluid. Of course, that is also true. But I think what I found more interesting in my own research was to work out or to try to sketch and work out a feasible alternative approach to social memory. And by doing this, I approached the cohorts of people that I interviewed on both sides of this warped wire fences that is on both Armenia and the Lake Van region as humans that relate to the same shared but fragmented space. And here I wanted, instead of always reproducing the idea of reconstructing as a so-called Armenian narrative, a so-called Kurdish narrative, a so-called Turkish narrative, I rather wanted to shift it a bit and look at two other axes that form a kind of matrix through which I understand collective memory in the region. And that is, and this is very important, these four dimensions, four realms of memory, they are not exhaustive. I will also address the kind of shortcomings. So the four dimensions that I specifically focused on was locality, temporality, ideology, and genealogy. That is, I wanted to look at to which degree does socialization, in particular family, also the intergenerational micro-narrative of a given family affect the way how people make sense of a past that is, of course, beyond their reach. We always invoke the notion of remembering, but actually it is most probably technically from a psychological perspective even wrong to speak of something like someone is remembering 1915. I think nowadays, if people do remember, it is a handful of 10 people. For the rest, that is us, it would be right to rather say that we narrate the past, right? So one thing is to look at this intergeneration aspect. The other thing was for me more like the kind of idea of locality, that is to look at whether socialization in different areas, in rural areas, in urban areas, in Yerevan, in Gyumri, to which degree does this impact the way how people make sense of the past? And ultimately, I think that's also something very interesting is, of course, the political worldview, right? And to which degree does this impact the way how people make sense of the past? And I think when we apply this fourfold prism, we see that memory collectives permeate, intersect with, and challenge the rigid categories of so-called national memory by itself. And it is actually through its very already form, not even through its content, but through its very form that they circumvent the national narratives. Because they, through their existence already, deny the very existence of a coherent national people based on which the national narrative bases its legitimacy. That is to say, I think there was this interesting kind of observation with regard to Lacan, where Žižek argues that the actual way of delegitimizing nationalist leaders is not to show them that they are actually not leaders, but to show that the imagination based on which they build their political power is not in this form existent as a totalitarian entity. So remembering the individual is here not only confined to being ethnically Armenian, Kurdish, or Turkish, that is the thing that we would have on the national collective. At the same time, it is always, and I think more prevalently, characterized by being member of other non-national collectives. For example, are you a local or a newcomer in a specific rural context? That has significant implications because it does matter in the narrative whether your relatives themselves were living in a Kurdish village during the Armenian genocide, or whether you were actually relocated to this village after the village was cleared of Armenians or Assyrians. The question is also, which generation do you belong to? And with regard to this, I think that plays a specific role with regard to both the Armenian and the Kurdish side. That is, with regard to Armenia, it does play a role whether you belong to a generation socialized in the Soviet Union where serving alongside so-called Turks, as it referred to in Armenia, in the Soviet army, that is Azerbaijanis or Tatars from Kazan during your Soviet years in the army, whether you actually coexisted with non-Armenians, Muslims in Yerevan during the Soviet period, or whether you're already born into the actual destruction of the First Karabakh War. And on the other hand, I think in the Kurdish case, we have also this intergenerational tension, I think, with specifically when it comes to the question, to which degree do we owe ourselves, to which degree do we owe us ourselves to either historical truth or to the honor of our predecessors. And I think there we have a very similar and kind of painful process that we have also with regard, or that we had also with regard to the first post-Holocaust generation in Germany, right? So this question of, okay, there's one thing to come to terms with a kind of historical event as an abstract entity, but to which degree is it really possible to come to terms with the role one's own family members did play or did not play in the event? So I think that is also an important question. And then, of course, there's also the question of how do people present day relate to state authority in general? So how is the narrative about 1915 from, let's say, a Kurd who collaborated with Turkish authorities during the 90s, who is with someone that staunchly positions herself or himself against it? How does this impact also the way how people look through the prism of, for example, the warfare between the Turkish state and PKK in the 90s, to how you make sense of what happened 100 years ago, right? So I think these are the kind of different prisms that can shape and that can fundamentally alter the way how people that are perceived as part of one national group actually do make sense of a past that is beyond our direct experiential access. So depending on one's own particularly collective rooting, so each participant who was interviewed was compelled somehow to navigate her or his personal story in a field of tension made up by different and at times conflicting collective narratives. Because, I think that's something that I really tried to stress throughout my work, when we look at the way how we do remember, and including how we do re-narrate historical narratives, and that I think applies to all of us, our single aim is not only to evoke a certain historical truth. That is also relevant. Of course, we believe that the stories we tell are true. But what is important is also that through the way we tell them, through the things that we stress, and through the things we also omit, we try to also underpin certain collective bonds with groups that we want to belong to, right? So, for example, if let's assume you are a very faithful person in today, which links you also to the idea of an imagined religious community, but you find out that in a given historical event of violence, religious dignitaries actually played a crucial role in justifying collective violence up until horrendous murder. How can you position yourself? Are you able to narrate this historical event while at the same time being still able to maintain your collective bonds with a group that you want to belong to? So I think what is something, in my opinion, that has been always on an abstract level recognized in memory studies, but that has been not to the full extent been put into the focus, is the question, to what degree do the stories that we tell us about the world that we want to belong to and the world from which we want to also distinguish ourselves?
Thank you so much. Such a fascinating way to have an understanding of this conflicting and broad topics. Well, Dr. Leopold, we have taken up a lot of your time. And before we say goodbye, could you talk a little bit about your current or future projects that you work on?
Yeah, sure. Well, with pleasure. Together with the Heinrich Böll Foundation, with the Yerevan office of the Heinrich Böll Foundation, we're currently actually in the process of translating the book into Armenian, and it's planned to be published still this year. However, my new research continues to a certain extent to explore the role of the past in the present, which I think that is really at the heart of my research over the last years. I somehow shift stronger my focus towards materiality and here urban materiality in particular. And in this context, I'm looking at the legacy of socialist urbanity with a specific focus on Central Asia and the Caucasus. And here more specifically speaking alongside Armenia, which again will feature as a place that I want to engage with more in my research, that also of Central Asian Republic of Kyrgyzstan. There, I look at socialist cities which were built towards another, a communist future, yet they find themselves somehow deadlocked in a different temporality. That is, of course, the temporality of a post-utopian present, or in what we could call an eternal dawn of capitalism. So what I'm turning here is to the rich texture of the historical experience across a vast geography stretching from both Central Asia to Central Europe. For instance, I retraced the trajectory of a Czechoslovak commune of internationals who left their native home in Žilina, that is in present-day Slovakia, to form an Esperanto-speaking commune and build the first electrified district in Bishkek, Central Asia. I also want to look at the counter city envisioned by Mazmanyan and Gevorg Kocar and other Armenian futurist architects in opposition to the Sozrealism of so-called neo-Armenian Stalinist architecture in Yerevan. And I want to shed light on the fascinating joint project of a Russian-Georgian biologist and a Kyrgyz-Jewish philosopher to build an experimental eco-town in the vicinity of Soviet Moscow. So the guiding question here for my research is, how do the abandoned visions of the past speak to us as the disillusioned, cynical citizens of the 21st century? I think that is my fundamental question for my upcoming research.
Okay, thank you so much. I think, we are good to go. I'll just stop recording and save this, but can you just stay here?